Love. I had my first kiss on Sunday, May 1st, 2011. It's easy to remember the exact date because it happened on the day we all learned Osama bin Laden had been killed. I was 28 years old. I had been in Los Angeles for the weekend and was taking the train back home to San Diego. It's a 3-hour trip. I remember that I was getting into San Diego late, around 10:30 p.m. This was before Uber, in the days when friends had to pick you up from the airport or train station. The sky had just drifted into darkness, and I was reading a magazine in my seat on the train. The car was neither crowded nor empty, just a dozen or so people sitting quietly. At about 8:45 p.m., a woman stood up with a sense of urgency. "Osama bin Laden has been killed!" There was a beat of silence, and then people cheered. Strangers locked eyes, saying, "Wow," and "Oh my God." I checked Twitter on my phone and saw that President Obama was addressing the nation. I opened the Al Jazeera news stream, and there was the president talking in mid-sentence. Quote, "Has conducted an operation that killed Osama bin Laden, the leader of Al-Qaeda, and a terrorist who's responsible for the murder of thousands of innocent men, women, and children. It was nearly 10 years ago that a bright September day was darkened by the worst attack on the American people in our history." As I watched with my headphones in, the train disappeared. For a moment, I was purely an American. Nothing else. I was an entity inside history. Then, when the announcement ended, I took off my headphones and returned to the train. It was buzzing with energy. People were talking and reading on their phones. Where was his body really? Would we see actual photos? I texted a boy named Jackson. "They killed Osama bin Laden." "I just saw," he wrote. "Wow." In other news, would you want to pick me up from the train? I get in at 10:30, though. It's so late. I would love to. Can I take you to a secret beach that I love? Ooh, bring a bottle of wine? Yes, duh. See you at 10:30. I'm excited. I texted Jackson because I thought he might have a crush on me. This was not something I deduced on my own. "Jackson likes you," a friend had said after seeing us hang out. "No, he doesn't," I insisted. No one has ever liked me. I had no metrics or experience in being crushed on, no intuition. My friend assured me I was wrong, that Jackson was all up on my stees. I had met Jackson a few weeks earlier because a mutual friend told me I should. He worked as a student chaplain at Point Loma Nazarene University, a conservative Christian college in San Diego, and had recently come out as gay. Not only that, but unapologetically so. Gay and Christian and a leader and proud of it. The Nazarene community erupted into a torrent of controversy. Do we fire him? He isn't acting on it yet. It divided the conservative staff and student body from the surprisingly sizable number of progressive students. Jackson was a micro-celebrity agitator. He knew the Bible better than most. He was ready to debate anyone and possessed a freedom I hardly knew. Someone put us on a text and we started talking. At 28 years old, I had only just decided I was willing to date men. I'd known I was different since I was 8. And known that I was gay from age 12. But at 18, I decided I wouldn't act on it until God told me I could. I didn't want to go against the plain reading of Scripture. Quote, "If a man lies with a male as with a woman, both of them have committed an abomination. They shall be put to death. Their blood is upon them," end quote. These aren't code words, they're clear warnings. I didn't want to weather the rejection and wrath of my entire Christian community, which included most of my friends. A year before that train ride, I'd been in a van driving down a bumpy road in Uganda when this approach started to rip me up beyond repair. I was there co-leading a tour for some of our nonprofit's donors. Taking a bunch of Americans on a 10-day trip to rural Uganda fast-tracks friendship. Lots of fireside talks and beer and sharing. Inside jokes being formed every mile. And the long drives between villages, through tall grass and unkempt mud roads, had us playing games and talking about all kinds of things. On this stretch, Everyone in the van started talking about when they had their first kiss. At age 14, at age 16, one person at age 21, and everyone gasped. My face got hot. It was not like me to get anxious when asked a question. But when someone jovially turned the conversation to me, I lied. I was so young, like 13, I don't even remember it, but it was so awkward. From there, I took control. Justin, do you remember yours? Or were you old enough to really remember? I knew Justin was a storyteller, and off he went. I laughed extra loud and hid behind the other stories. That was the first time in my life when I'd felt old and behind. Until then, I had done a miraculous job of feeling set apart, out of the game, and it worked. If you're not a gymnast, there's no reason to feel insecure about your double back handspring into a triple twist. Simone Biles can do it, and good for her. But you're not competing with her, so who cares? Maybe you can watch a gymnastics tournament and yell at the TV and have all kinds of opinions. This is how I felt about romance. My friends were torn up about boyfriends and girlfriends, this relationship imploding while that one was on fire. I'd become a go-to for processing and advice while leaving myself completely out of it. In the years since, I'd been busy. New friends, spiritual awakenings, a dream job at a nonprofit I believed in. And lucky for me, I wasn't walking around looking like a Hemsworth. I was cute but not beautiful, so straight girls and gay boys weren't crashing their cars into mine for attention. I was funny and, on top of that, oblivious. So deeply entrenched in the Christian world that I didn't know any openly gay people. Or maybe I knew a few, but they were on the periphery. To pursue friendship with them would mean exposing myself to undue temptation and risking my role as the token gay character in a group of straight friends. Self-hatred can walk around disguised as successful assimilation. Through it all, I had simply never noticed that I'd reached my late 20s without ever kissing anyone. Until I noticed. And then I felt deeply lacking, embarrassed, less than human. I spent the rest of that Uganda trip wondering if I'd missed my chance, if I was too far behind to be fully human. Somewhere deep in my mind, I was taking apart the things that had kept me unkissed. I was closing the Bible. I was plugging my ears. I was trying to think for myself. As I rode the train south with Osama's dead body on everyone's lips, I thought, who is going to pick me up this late? Then I did the thing that so many before me have done. I thought, maybe this guy will inconvenience himself for me. If he really does have a crush on me, he'll pick me up. He quickly said yes. I remember thinking, whoa, that's cool. Am I in the game? The train pulled into the station around 10:30, and there he was, wearing a maroon t-shirt and khaki shorts that showed his strong legs. His blonde hair perfectly curled up like a wave. He even parked his car and met me inside the station, a highly unnecessary and deeply chivalrous move. We walked to his car, where he had a bottle of red wine and a paper bag on the front seat. So there is this little beach facing Coronado, in the bay. No one knows about it. I'm taking you there, he said, smiling mischievously. Oh, wow, I thought I'd explored all of San Diego. I have no idea where you're talking about. I exaggerated my ignorance to make him feel extra knowledgeable. I'm stoked about this wine, I said, grabbing his shoulder with a sustained hold. Goodbye, Osama, deserves a drink. This, as many of you will know, is called flirting. Most people begin flirting very young and practice it in their early teens. It is play fighting, conscious and subconscious touching. You act insulted by their every move, testing them, I guess, forcing them to protest and say that they didn't mean it, that they really care about you. The language of flirtation is indirect, plausible deniability. This works well for closeted gay boys. They can flirt and call it friendship. Even in my asexual youth, I did this. I did it with lots of straight boys, and they did it back. I lived in the broad, undefined sexual limbo of male friendship, a soup of joking, wrestling, and deep affection through Christian intimacy and spiritual deep talks. Something sexual was always humming in the ether. though calling it sexual feels like a betrayal. It was just magnetism, not entirely sexual, but somehow related. I fell in love with my straight best friends a few times, once in high school, once in college, and once after. This love masked itself in me as best friendship, as being inseparable. As writing what can only be described as love notes to each other, and always speaking about the friendship itself, how extraordinary it was. I didn't recognize it as love, but it was. They could spend every minute with me, endless sleepovers and hugs and talks till sunrise. They could love me in every way except with their skin. But this unrequited love, however well justified in my head, stored up in my heart like enriched uranium. An explosive not having. A longing for completion that vibrated through my whole body. The feeling was invisible to me until I got into that car with Jackson. On the drive, we flirted openly, touching hands to knees, laughing at everything. And the potential end of this flirting was full embrace, sexual touch. I felt it coming, the biological end purpose of flirting. For the first time in my life, I was playing the game of nature. Though the goal of that biological game, procreation, is unlikely, the programming remains. We turned onto a random side street behind a strip mall, then parked on a residential street. The houses were nice, as are all houses in coastal San Diego. There was a little path between them, almost invisible through the trees. We walked down it and ended up on a sandy beach, a small crescent of sand behind the houses. The water of the bay was still, like a lake, and the lights of downtown San Diego shimmered across it. Jackson had a blanket under his arm and wine in his other hand. He picked a spot and laid the blanket down. I opened the twist cap wine. We sat down and drank from the bottle. To be honest, I don't remember what we talked about. Maybe Osama bin Laden. Maybe the music we were listening to or our weekend activities. I do remember how easily I slipped into being pursued. He touched my knee. I let him. I laughed and shuffled closer at his jokes. We drank the wine. Everything was funny. Somehow his leg was thrown over mine. I pulled it closer. I let it thread my legs. We were there, talking about nothing, when he leaned in and kissed me. I will be very forensic about this. He lightly bit my lower lip. He didn't rush in with the tongue. He pulled me in with his right hand while holding himself up with his left. He didn't know it was my first time. I was in the kiss and at the same time floating above it. This is not an unusual experience, especially during a big moment like sex or graduation or a wedding. We are watching ourselves do the thing as we do the thing. We are wondering how we look. But there is an added lucidity to it when it happens at age 28. I wasn't a teenager, disgusted by my changing body, intoxicated by my hormones, clumsy in my newness on the earth. I was an adult man. I knew who I was and even liked myself. I knew how to live and make money and make friends. All these other confusions weren't swarming in the mix. They were more or less settled. So this newness, this discovery, was crystallized in its isolation. For transparency's sake, it wasn't exactly my first time. I had kissed a girl, Natalie, during my sophomore year of college. She heard that I hadn't kissed anyone and announced in the sushi restaurant that she would teach me. She was sitting next to her boyfriend, who knew very well that I was her gay sidekick. She scooted close to me and gave me instructions. Keep your lips soft but firm. Don't use your tongue too much, but you can a little. Don't bang your teeth. But don't stay too far away. None of these rules made any sense. We gave it a try. Okay, less like eating a sandwich, she said. Yikes. I tried again, and I can't tell if I got better or she gave up. That was the first and last time my lips had touched lips, and I never counted it as my first kiss because that seems to require some level of attraction, right? Not cold education, but hunger. As Jackson kissed me, I wondered if I was okay at it. One thing I could tell, he was liking it. He now had me on my back, and we were squirming, legs braiding, My mind was busy. Is this making out? This feels really nice. Wow, the mouth-on-mouth contact is so intimate. Now I understand why Julia Roberts wouldn't kiss any of the men in Pretty Woman. Wow, having someone's weight on you is sexy. Oh no, our teeth hit. Okay, control the teeth, Jed. Wow, his mouth tastes like a mouth. Gamey or something, which should be gross, but I'm into it. I'm very into it. We kissed and made out for however long. It was a wholly positive experience. Maybe it approached midnight or later and it was time to go. I had work the next day. We got back in his car and held hands. We laughed a lot. We kissed again as I got out of the car at my house. I wanted more kisses. I felt accomplished, more human, no longer as incomplete. I was still 2 years away from having sex for the first time, but now I was on the train track. And as much as I'd glorified shucking the assembly line of life, doing my own thing and not fitting in, all I'd ever wanted to do was belong, to be human in the most fundamental way. The accoutrement could be rebellious, but the bones needed to be solid, even ordinary. I wanted to be in love and have a husband and maybe a family. I have, in the years since that kiss, played the game that everyone else is always playing. I've dated. I've struggled to understand my faith's fraught relationship with body and desire. I've peeled away shame like healing sunburnt skin. I've had a few boyfriends. I've released a hell of a lot of oxytocin. I've flirted and made out and had some sex. Not a ton, but some. I still feel very green. At 37, I do this little equation in my head all the time. Most people start dating at 17 or have sex around then. So if I started at 30, that means I'm romantically 24. Maybe it's not bad that I'm still figuring this all out. The longing to find someone is one of life's most fundamental feelings. Our music celebrates or vilifies it. Our movies and TV shows, too. Our long talks with friends so often revolve around it. Love is hard. We expect our romantic partners to be our best friends, the objects of our desire, the home we return to, and the adventure we seek. We want to lust for them like strangers, but trust them like family. We want to keep some mystery, but begrudge them if they keep secrets. We want them to be an entire community in one, to be every member of the village. When they can't satisfy all of those needs, and of course they can't, our eyes and thoughts stray as we wonder if we've made a mistake. We expect to know our soulmates when we see them without question, like Rachel McAdams grinning under Spanish moss. Any doubt, any testing throws the fantasy into disarray. We've combined Western individualism with the ancient institution of marriage. It is no longer a contract to ensure the safety of life and family in a hostile world. It is now supposed to be the miraculous meeting of two independent souls who complement each other in perfect harmony. How then do we proceed? How do we find and keep love? Is it even possible? Ask me what it's like to be in love, and I will say, "Have you ever been in love?" If you tell me no, I will try to use a metaphor, but it won't work. If you ask me, "Do you know what it's like to lose your mother?" I will say, "No, but I did lose my grandmother." And you will say, "No, it is not like that." If I ask you, "Is being a mother everything you thought?" You will say, "No, it's more. I can't explain it." The truest things are unteachable. I can study a map of Patagonia for 100 years and know a hell of a lot about it. I can wow people at cocktail parties with my knowledge. But then one woman strolls in who has been there, stood there, felt there, and I am a buffoon. A map is helpful, of course. It can show you the way and keep you safe, but it must be used in tandem with the going. Words are maps to human experience, helpful, full of tips and tricks, but life must be lived for the words to make sense. The most beautiful or heartbreaking things, which are often so near to each other, can only be felt. It makes me wonder why we force kids to read the classics. I read Steinbeck in 8th grade. I hated it. In my life, I've seen 1,000 photos of an eclipse. So have you. But actually standing beneath one, feeling one, having the world go dark in the middle of the day, screaming with your friends and imagining ancient people losing their shit over the insanity, the godliness of it. Words are garbage until you've seen the thing they describe. Then words are a way to spread it around to your fellow witnesses to keep the feeling going. Words are meant for the living. If you love someone, you must learn to speak their language. If your words do not mean the same thing, you'll end up talking at them and resenting them for not understanding you. Seek first to listen and learn the meaning of their words. I went to a beautiful wedding in Big Sur, and the whole experience reminded me of how different love is from friendship. I mean the love that leads to marriage, to commitment. It is concerned with the future, the promises, the excitement of all that lies ahead. Deep friendship is recognition that two people are already on the same journey with the same destination. It's a fun high five on the path. Love is that too, but also the knowledge that the other person is the journey, that the other person is part of your life's big commission, partnership. At the same time, there is no real loss of self. There is always autonomy. It is a paradox between separateness and oneness. I remember having a chat with Ruthie one time about all this. "I think I could be single forever," I said. "I don't need another person to feel whole. I like who I am single." "Of course you do," she said. "We all do. Because then we can live in perfect selfishness. We can bounce and leave whenever we want. We can ghost. We can ignore or move on a whim. When you commit your heart to another, you learn about your selfishness, your laziness, your quirks and idiosyncrasies that are invisible to you on your own. You miss a whole half of who you are when you don't bare your underbelly to the heart of another. And of course that is scary, but that's what falling in love is for. It overrides your fear, and you just do it whether you want to or not." Well, that was damning and true. It's one thing to be happy alone, whole in yourself, to be open to love but happy without it. It's another to reject love because of fear, to choose safety over the bigness of risking your heart. The heart and the head. I obsess over their disagreements. They misunderstand each other or ignore each other. And the barrage of mixed signals from one to the other is the root of anxiety. Take heartbreak, for example. How funny that the head knows the heart, knows how it feels and why, but the heart cannot hear the head. It is one-way communication. You know the path forward. You know you will feel better with time. You know that timing is God, and that somewhere down the road you'll be thankful for it all and amused at how much you'd thought you lost. You know it all, but each feeling hits you fresh, as if the heart had no premonition or warning, as if it's not listening to you, because it's not. The heart cannot hear. It bangs through a dark kitchen, burning its hands on everything and swearing it smells something good. It must learn, and it does, but only through experience and over time. And yes, sometimes the heart was right all along. That's the rub. I can do something, know it's wrong, beat myself up for it, and keep doing it, helpless. This is not rare. A friend of mine is having trouble with a new relationship. "I have tried to sabotage this thing at every turn," he said. "She is kind to me, loving and patient. She knows I haven't dated much and that I have intimacy issues." He gulped down his cocktail and kept spilling his guts. "She is so patient with me and my shit. It took me months before I admitted to myself that I really liked her. She was taking that wall down brick by brick, and it worked. I finally feel like I'm present with her, just enjoying her, not freaking out. But man, the last few months were torture, because I knew I was blowing something good. I couldn't help myself. I would send her away and then lie in bed all night and ask myself, what the hell is wrong with me?" How devilish is the division of our mind and our motivations. It's like we watch ourselves from behind soundproof glass, and our bodies act out a horror show before us. I think a lot of people are living in fortresses, built from wounds and the mess of growing up complex in a world that oversimplifies us. I think the work of adulthood is taking down walls and allowing people with big and patient love to take them down for us. But sheesh, if the walls are down, where is your defense? What about the little boy in middle school, scared of the big watching world? I suppose that's where we choose adulthood, choose the harder way, choose strength. The madness of having a crush. The checking to see if they've been tagged in new photos, if they're commenting on photos and whose photos. The internet has turned anyone infected with infatuation into a private detective, a one-person Patriot Act surveillance team. I remember once being on a plane, trapped without stimuli and feeling so in love with someone that I thought I would claw my eyes out by the time I landed. My mind was lost in a spiral of imagining his thoughts and actions as personal attacks on me. How hilarious to remember that now. It wasn't hilarious then. What's most convicting is how selfish a crush is. It isn't an open-handed celebration of the other person, of saying how wonderful they are and letting them be what they are without attachment. It has little to do with them and everything to do with you, your value, your ownership, your success in seduction. They just happen to be the form your self-worth is possessing for the moment. Then, maybe they like you back, and the fire suddenly cools, and you wonder, wait, am I even ready for a relationship? Will my friends even like him? Do we have anything in common? Maybe this isn't so universal. Maybe I'm showing my cards. Whatever. I love reading my old journals and remembering the lunacy. Maybe I'll remember my laughter when this inevitably happens again. The first phase of having a crush is treacherous. You like how someone looks, their tone and vibe, the way they dress. The items on your checklist are getting checked. Ooh, they said something funny. Check. They like black coffee and Rascal Flats. This is looking good. Right about then, somewhere between your eyes and stomach, the pheromones kick in and start pulling the levers of your brain. And this person becomes all you can think about. This is when things can go wrong. Imagine you have a long checklist of traits that you think make someone compatible. It's maybe 50 things if you're picky, or 15 if you're not. Some of these things you could list off right now. Others are subconscious, preferences you don't know you have, and you know them only when you see them. Check or yikes. The trickiness of the crush is that your brain does something unfair in this moment. This dreamy human has checked off the first 5 on the list. Looking good, right? Then the brain just goes ahead and checks off everything else. Check, 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 check. Right then, they become fantasy. Could this person be the answer to my holy checklist? Could they? And so, you create a fake person. You imagine someone who looks like your crush, sounds like your crush, but has all your checks checked. You want to date that person. But the person, the real person, I mean, keeps showing you who they are. And suddenly, check number 47 gets X'd out. Then 24. One after another. And you resent your boyfriend or girlfriend for not being the person your imagination created them to be. Maybe you settle, stick around. Still, you are hurt and angry and in knots at the tiny deaths of your fantasy. In your resentment, you might not see that a lot of your checklist was unnecessary or misguided. And when you feel that nodding, you take it out on this poor person who never promised to be anyone but who they really are. Chances are, they did this to you, too. Couples want the romance to last. They say they don't want to lose the spark. What they mean is the electric sense of mystery that was present in the beginning. Romance was the journey from crush to relationship, when you wondered if the other person was the fulfillment of your desires and needs, and for a time they were. Every exchange, every dinner, every kiss was charged with these questions. Charged with, what if they are everything I ever wanted? And what if they are more than I could have imagined? This exhilaration is rooted in the wondering, in the hopeful uncertainty. It is the questions that give it energy, not the answers. Of course, this type of wondering isn't sustainable, nor should it be. Travel is the same. I want seduction. Perhaps the new place will give me what I need, answer my questions, wake me up, free me. The romance of travel is the hope of what it can teach me, show me. And just like love, it makes me feel completely, frantically alive. But there is a time for the thirst of romance, and there is a time for building a home. You realize that the street you live on is overflowing with wonders. The world is a teacher, not only because it is new, but because it is both yours and never completely yours, and ever-changing. In time, romance and commitment become one thing, an inhale and an exhale. I hope to live my sunset years nestled in this understanding. Why does something have to last forever to be right? Why can't you move to a foreign city and kiss some randoms and rent a flat and then come back and start again? Why can't you fall in love and discover it wasn't right and move on while thanking the relationship for what it was? Love doesn't seem to allow this because it trades in absolutes, in forevers. That is what falling in love is, the endless planning and dreaming, the holding of the beloved with the pulsing hope that this holding will extend beyond the horizon. I don't think you can fall in love and know for sure that it is temporary. That isn't love. That is sex and fun and friendship. But I do think you can fall in love with the sober wisdom that humans change and factors arise that are beyond the calculations of anyone. And if that happens, it isn't the end of the world. It is the real world. There doesn't have to be a villain for someone to get hurt. As I get older and listen to my life, the truest things seem to live in paradoxical tension, hope holding hands with understanding, expectation dancing with the hard lessons of humility, the human heart piloting the mystery of the human heart. Nothing is so cold as desire unfulfilled. You want something or someone so bad, and your mind works at it like a cancer, eating at you until you don't recognize yourself. We have all been in this place. But real life is wise and denies you things from time to time. Wisdom is not gentle, but it is kind, because it knows the real world is where peace lives. It knows that the happiness of fulfilled desire is as lasting as the first bite of cake. My friend Elizabeth asked me a tough question. If all your exes were asked to describe you in one word, what word would they agree on? I don't have enough exes to form some sort of chorus, but my guess would be self-forgiving. I am such a student of living, so interested in my own nature and the lessons to be learned from my mistakes, that I think I may forgive myself too quickly. I say to myself, Jed, you didn't know better until now. Now you know. Good on you. All the while, I may have hurt someone. I don't know if I really understand the words should have. This is a common characteristic of fast talkers. We can sew a silver story around anything we do and leave people spinning under a spell. Leave them hurt and feeling dumb for feeling hurt and without the words to defend their position. I want to grow, to do right by others and myself, to trust the open doors and knock on the closed ones. But I sometimes get scared of my own mind, of my words, of my ability to forgive myself, of my self-assuredness. I need to let myself feel confusion. I need to be embarrassed once in a while. I need to cry and feel and know that I can't explain it all away. I need the powerlessness of fog. I'm leaning into the middle place, the unknowing, the place I don't control. The first boy I ever had a crush on was in the 8th grade. I mean, we both were. I'll call him Charlie. At the time, I was soft and pale and covered in acne. I swam with my shirt on. I had no knees, just white tubes for legs. Charlie was cool. He had a six-pack. He was tan and funny. He spoke like an adult. He broke rules, and he was nice to me. Maybe he was patronizing me, or even snickering behind my back to his cool friends. But at that age, the fact that his godlike face even looked at me, knew my name, it felt good. The hormones and confusion transformed him into something more than a person. He became an icon of desire. But it wasn't just desire, it was envy. I don't know if this is something straight people experience, but when you're attracted to the same sex, there's another layer mixed in. Not only do I desire the person, but I compare myself to them, their body, their hair, their face. I long for it, and I'm jealous of it, or feel shame for my inadequacy. The natural otherness of heterosexuality may insulate most people from this feeling. But for me, it was just another charge in the electric chaos of my feelings. Middle school, man, those years, when the innocence and isolation of childhood are plugged into the circuit board of the world, of comparison and longing, and all that electricity comes flowing in like a flood in a canyon, and we all get fried. Never go to bed angry. I've heard that said at so many wedding toasts. I'm sure it's mostly true, but my brain doesn't work like that. I get emotional or upset, and when I go to bed, the quiet darkness of my dreaming calms the growling wolf. I wake up the next day feeling much better. The thing that stirred me up feels smaller, or at least my reason gets a go at it apart from my hot chest and feelings. Sleep does wonders. I'm an external processor and an optimist. My words are tests. They leap out from me, and I watch how they land. That's how I discover what I think and feel. I have friends who process in their heads. I'm not sure if they're thinking in silent sentences, but they seem to consider all the roads before they pick one. I'm sure that's a better way to be. I rarely ask for directions, but I thank God for sleep. I don't think well when I'm awake, I just talk. But when I sleep, I rise with new understanding, as if wisdom entered into my ears like a dust storm. In the morning, I can see. The dust has settled and the landscape is revealed before me. I am not married and never have been. But when I've been worked up about something in my past relationships, talking about it has sent us deeper into the double helix dance of misunderstanding. But a good night's sleep did some rearranging. I've woken up and forgotten why we were fighting at all. I think this is why I've always loved the look of people sleeping. No matter how big, tough, rugged, fierce, or loud while awake, a sleeping person is innocent, helpless and soft, regal. Some people are madly in love and wrong for each other. Magnets on fire. The sex is amazing and the fighting never ends. The contempt, the cutting remarks in front of friends, or life circumstances that would never work. One person a nomad, the other domestic. One wants kids, the other never. To me, this is one of the most unfortunate burdens of having a human heart. You love each other, you come together with passion and connections so deep it is certainly instinctual from a million years ago. But your ego, the rational part of you, picks at the other person, cuts them down. They cut you down, and you pout to force their hand. You would die for them, and they just might kill you, but your chemistry is a puppeteer, and losing them feels like death. The moment the loss happens, you feel as if you have misplaced the best thing in your life. You forget the fighting and misery. The wise counsel of your friends is a foreign language, the murmurings of a Charlie Brown adult. You are driven by a mystery that turns the ship without your consent. This is a great sadness of being human. We are both an ancient monkey and a supercomputer. They often don't get along. Desires and instincts misaligning in pain. This happens in love, career, family, so many things. So little of life is rational. But I will say this. When the chemicals drain from the brain and a moment's rest gives your thoughts some clarity, there comes a time when you can bandage the wounds and prepare for the next hurricane. At least you'll know you aren't crazy. You're human, and everyone knows the feeling. Weddings are one of the few traditions in our culture with a structure that we mostly adhere to. And a lot of us point our lives toward that event, setting it in our own stories as a pinnacle, a goal, a mile marker of achievement. This can cause a lot of idolatry and grief and impossible expectations. I've been to a lot of incredible weddings, beautiful celebrations of commitment, but they can blur together and feel performed rather than experienced. The feeling of, okay, we're supposed to say this now, and now this. Vendors inflating fees, stuffy clothes choking laughter, fantasies dashed on the hardness of reality. Well, I just felt something new. I went to the best wedding yet. Because the people getting married morphed the ceremony, honed it, changed it to feel fresh and honest. It wasn't in a church or a building. It was in a grove of redwoods. We dressed in costumes, white and gold. I wore tights and spray-painted my white jacket gold. Face paint everywhere. The decorations were hung by friends. Everyone camped in tents and teepees by the river. For the ceremony, the local college marching band led us in a celebratory march through a persimmon grove. The bride and groom read vows that expressed the honest surprise that a partner could be found in this life, a comrade. They didn't pretend they were perfect. They celebrated the shadow and the light, conscious that they were signing up for a lifetime of self-discovery. We danced until 4 a.m. under the unpolluted bright stars of rural Northern California. The whole thing made me feel as if marriage had just been invented, a brilliant new idea. That night, I didn't feel the sting of comparison, of, wow, I hope I find this one day. I was too wrapped up in the awe that such a thing could exist at all, that something so pure is a gift not to the couple alone, but to the community. Love is real. It's built in communities and orchards and the acts of working together and standing together. I was glowing that week as if a mirror could hold on to sunshine and reflect it around for days. I once read that babies see the world upside down for the first few days after they're born. The eye actually projects the world that way onto your retinas, and it takes the brain a little while to learn to flip it over. Your brain is doing that right now, flipping the world to appear as if it's standing right side up. I heard someone describe falling in love as being turned upside down. Whatever your brain had learned, that up is up and down is down, it changes. Your priorities are thrown in disarray. You don't sleep. You don't eat the same. You feel drugged. You are newly born. It happens outside of love, too. A conversation can be so mind-altering that I'll feel turned over for a minute. A new perspective or a loving challenge will cause me to rethink myself, and I must learn to see this new world right side up. It seems like life wants me to turn over my house sometimes and see what sticks to the floor. If you went to college and now live in a big city, you will probably be single longer than your parents were. People are getting married later, having kids later, especially the urban and the educated. The traditional time frame for starting a family has moved back a decade. So on one hand, being single has never been more okay. Spending time finding yourself, building your career, has never been more socially sanctioned. But the tension still lives. We may not feel anxious about being single at 24, but we do at 34. Many of my successful single lady friends have spent big money freezing their eggs. The finite window of fertility doesn't care about you finding the one. But it doesn't have to be about the limited life of eggs or safe pregnancy. It can be about your own life, about wanting love in your most able years, about the firework mythology of love. We want that big love. We want to be surprised by our person. We want the story to be worth telling and cooing about. We spend all this time building our best selves, and it makes us demand someone who has also done the same. 60 years ago, you married someone who was good enough. Over 50% of those marriages ended in divorce. But I don't think that's because they weren't proper soulmates. I think it's because the expectation of being with your soulmate became our dominant cultural expectation. So being in those marriages felt like a mistake. They got divorced and jumped into the river of big hopes for love. This is the tightrope I found myself walking. Accepting that being single is okay, that I'm happy with who I am, and if it's meant to be, it'll happen. But seek and you shall find. The person of your dreams isn't going to find you on the couch. I've heard stories of total life pivots coming from a chance encounter, a risky new job, a last-ditch effort to try something new, a rock-bottom whim. We've been attracted to the wrong people for the wrong reasons, seeking their affection or their bodies or their coolness to heal insecurities from middle school, self-hatred that thinks it can be erased by kissing the thing that hurt it. We've wanted a specific career, but when we achieve it, we find it empty of meaning. We've wanted marriage to escape loneliness and ridicule, only to end up lonelier in a marriage with a shiny fake smile. We think we know how things should be and how they will arrive. We don't know what's coming in our lives. We are like those doomsday pastors who predict the day and time of Christ's return, only to shrink in embarrassment when the predictions are wrong. There are two schools of thought at war with each other. One tells you to manifest your dreams, the other to surrender to the universe. I hear both talking to me from either shoulder. So what do we do? Well, I'm currently being torn limb from limb, dating and looking for the right one, wondering if this guy is going to be it or fade away, or if that other guy, the one I was really excited about who wasn't excited back, will ever circle back around. I don't know, but I can feel an answer in there somewhere. It has something to do with holding the paradox in your hands, playing with it, as the universe often invites us to do. Most things of real meaning are the humming tension between two opposites. Marriage, for example. Loving commitment to another autonomous soul. Becoming one and yet clearly separate. Sexual wanting and safe having. Adventure yet home. In the constant re-upping. In the flow of change and decision. I think God asks us to tango with it, to try things with gusto, to understand that we are ignorant actors in a cosmic drama, to believe we deserve things, knowing that we might be taught something surprising in our entitlement, to want with all our might, knowing that our wanting might be misguided, to risk the embarrassment of asking and to receive whatever the answer is. To walk in faith, not sit in faith. To move away from home because we must go out on our own, but to know deep down, if it all goes to shit, we can always move back in with mom. I learned a new word when I was in Brazil. Saudade. It is Portuguese. The word doesn't have a direct translation in English. It describes a deep, heavy longing, a nostalgia, a melancholic ache for an absent something or someone you love. It brings the happiness and sadness of love and longing together. It captures the hole in your sternum and stomach that knots and swells and can be filled by only one person or place. It often carries the sad subtext of knowing that the object of your love may never return. It pains you, and yet some quality of it feels good. It is both terrible and beautiful. You can even feel saudade for someone who is presently with you because you feel their future loss, even as you are with them now. For me, saudade captures those blessed, horrible seconds when you become aware of a perfect moment and feel it dripping through time, never to return again. Suddenly, you're watching it from outside your body, and your heart cries to cast it in iron and hold it forever. I wondered if English had words that Portuguese doesn't. I read online that Portuguese has saudade, but doesn't have atonement. How interesting. That the English have a word for paying for your sins, and the Brazilians have a word to celebrate the heartache of missing someone. I was having dinner with Ruthie a while back, and we fell into one of our late-night red wine couch conversations. We circled around the idea that you can't love others if you don't love yourself, that it isn't selfish to love yourself, because true love can come only from abundance, not from lack. Everything else is the ego seeking affirmation and the sexual instinct seeking release. I've dated guys who were simply my teenage self reaching back and getting what he never had. The jock I'd fantasized over in high school? I dated the equivalent of him as a 20-something. The chic cool kid? He was next. The hot business guy? Next. As if I was making up for lost time. My attractions were almost entirely formed by my old embarrassments, my old lusts. My body wanted what it had been denied in those years when my sexuality turned on. I knew these guys were wrong. I knew our lives didn't mesh or match. But my attraction was driving my insecurities and lacks. If you are motivated by insecurity and self-hatred or embarrassment, you will use your relationships to heal those wounds. You'll look to attention, attraction, and distraction as a way to fix yourself. You are always aware of how you're coming across, dragging behind you the fear of being left out, forgotten, or found annoying. You are often offended. Ruthie and I talked about how the most loving people we know are so comfortable in their own skin that the attention they give and love they share is totally free of expectations and baited traps. These people rarely get their feelings hurt because they aren't worried how they're coming across or how they're being treated. They're too busy being interested in everyone and everything else. I don't know how to help someone love themselves, but if we stopped treating one another as a means to an end, but rather as the end itself, I think it would help. Maybe that's the key to it all. You are an end in and of itself, and so is your beloved. I have yet to prove this to myself, but I've seen it, and I believe it.